Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Culloden.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Culloden and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, can you tell the difference between an AI agent and a person? This week, we ask if customer service is on the way out. And the head of the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council talks to me about warning the government on spending. Plus this. Yes, a real life succession. We hear about the Rupert Murdoch new plan to stop his family feud. You can email the show at takingstock@newstalk.com or you can message me on social media at Susan Hayes Culloden. Now, I want to start off this week by explaining to you the term disinflation, as we say, because this week US inflation hit 2.9%, but in contrast, the ECB, the European Central Bank, has held firm on rates in the Eurozone. Now, disinflation is when inflation is happening, but at a slower pace than before. So it's not to be confused with deflation, which is falling prices. And the reason this is relevant is that when we see what's going on with inflation and how it's diverging across the Atlantic, when you know the difference between inflation, disinflation and deflation, it all makes more sense. Well, it is the family that is said to have inspired succession. It's the business that brought us Page Three Girls, Sky TV and Fox News. It's the patriarch in his 90s who can still date Gerry Hall. Yes, it is the Murdochs. Peace and the future direction of both family and business seem to have been achieved with the settlement this week. But what was that settlement and how did it come to this? I'm joined by Hannah Miller, media reporter at Bloomberg. So first of all, Hannah, can you take us through the brands that are within the Murdoch empire that have been built over the past 70 years for our audience today?
Yes. So Rupert Murdoch has built one of the most powerful media empires in the world. In the US, you know, it's home to famous names like The Wall Street Journal, Fox News, Fox Sports. It's really, really something where they're at. You know, Fox News is the most watched cable news network in the U.S. There's also the New York Post, which is a famous tabloid here. And they're actually expanding to the West Coast with the California Post. So there are a lot of moving pieces to this empire. And Rupert Murdoch has been the figurehead, the main face of the empire for decades now.
Well, speaking of decades, he's 94 years old. He was born in Australia. He seems to quite enjoy being married, actually, Hannah, because he's done so five times and he's got six children. And before we get into the detail of the settlement, can you walk us through the family tree, please?
It's a complicated family tree. So you mentioned his children. He has a daughter from his first marriage named Prudence. And from his second marriage, he has three kids, Lachlan, Elizabeth and James. And then from his third marriage to Wendy Deng, he has two daughters, Grace and Chloe. And, you know, he's been married multiple times since that third wife, including to Gerry Hall. And his current wife is Elena Zhukova.
Right. There's a lot going on there. All right. And you know what? There's a lot of longevity in those genes because his mother, Dame Elizabeth Murdoch, lived to 103. So we could have another decade yet of the trials and tribulations, if not more. But let's get into his head for a moment. Difficult as that might be. But at this point, he's 94. He's got his six children. He's got this media empire that has been built over an extended period of time. Certainly not without its controversy. We'll get to that. But what do you think, Hannah, is most important to him when it comes to succession? Is it money? Is it control, particularly beyond the grave? Is it favoritism within his family? Is it the business? Is it his narrative around media? What's important to Rupert Murdoch?
So we learned from a very messy battle over the family trust last year that political influence is extremely important to Rupert Murdoch. He actually was trying to ensure that his eldest son, Lachlan, was going to take over the company. And he argued for that because he and Lachlan share a similar conservative viewpoint. Fox News, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Post, these are all conservative news brands that are right-leaning in the U.S. He wanted someone to take up the mantle and preserve that conservative right-leaning image. And he argued that his three of his other kids, and that's Prudence, Elizabeth, and James, that they would try to push these brands more to the left, and that would ultimately hurt their value. So that was the argument he was trying to make when he was trying to alter the trust last year. He was not able to do that. A Reno probate court ruled against him. And that takes us to the settlement today. A lot shifted between that ruling and what we've seen happen this week.
But if we go back to where this came from in the first place, it was his second wife who said, right, what's going to happen here in our divorce is that you, Rupert, is going to have four votes, and the four children, at that point, Grace and Chloe hadn't come along by then, the four children were going to have a vote each. And therefore, if it is the case that the three siblings who you mentioned, Elizabeth, Prudence and James, if they were to go up against Lachlan and Rupert, then there could be a real challenge to the objective that you had just said. Is that ultimately where the root of this has come from?
Yeah, we know that the Murdochs sort of talked about this concern of succession and what's going to happen in the company, in part because they were inspired by the TV show Succession, which is mirrored, you know, about which mirrors their sort of struggles and, you know, these internal family, this internal family strife. So we know that this topic of succession really came up as the show Succession got more popular.
Isn't it ironic that Succession is inspired by the Murdochs and Succession drove then the Murdochs to talk about Succession, the actual one?
Yeah, life imitates art. And you explained it perfectly. You know, this original family trust agreement that Rupert had put together with the influence of his second wife was that, you know, those first four children would get equal voting power over how the companies were run. That has now changed. It's Lachlan who has that voting power now. And that's the result of this settlement that has been reached with the three other kids, who will get a $1.1 billion payout for each of them as the result of a stock sale.
What I find very interesting about the narrative around the $1.1 billion each is I've been listening to people talk about this during the week, and some people say, well, the three of them give up the fight. Hannah, who do you think really won here? Because Lachlan has had to borrow $1 billion in order to deal with this. He's got he's 54. He's got a really big business to handle. And the other three, I mean, and all pretty wealthy in their own right, and we'll get into each of the three individuals themselves. But I wonder here, who do you think has really won this week? Rupert? Lachlan? James? Who?
So we actually had some comments from Lachlan on this yesterday. He was speaking at a conference run by Goldman Sachs, and he said this decision, this settlement, has brought total clarity for the company, that they can just focus now on their strategy. They don't have to worry about this, and then it's good for investors. So he's really pushing this forward as a victory for himself. You know, I think for the family, probably emotional stability is very important. You know, I can only speculate here, but we know Lachlan is pushing this forward as a victory, not only for himself, but for Fox and News Corp, the two companies that really underpin this empire.
But it's interesting in those comments, he said total clarity for the company. The company. He didn't necessarily say just for him. I'm just intrigued by who has really won out here as a result of this. But if we also, can we just talk about Chloe and Grace? So they're around about 22, 24. They now will be economically linked to this trust, and then there would be separate trusts for each of them anyway. But they will not be functionally linked to the business. So Lachlan is basically driving on now, independent of his five siblings, but yet Grace and Chloe will actually benefit from this, which is in contrast to what the second wife initially wanted in the first place.
Yes, you know, there is this equity that they have, but at the end of the day, the battle here was for the voting power. You know, Rupert Murdoch did want all of his kids to benefit equally on the equity side. He didn't show favoritism there. But when it comes to power, when it comes to succession, Lachlan has been his chosen heir for quite a while now. You know, Lachlan has been essentially running these companies for several years now. He's been making the decisions. This really just cements his influence over the Murdoch empire.
And so you're based in New York, Hannah. What is the future of the business now, do you think? And particularly, as you mentioned, the right-leaning voice from a political point of view and how that moves in the media in the months and years ahead, do you think?
Yeah, so I think this really further establishes Fox News as a leading, you know, conservative news source in the U.S. I will say that, you know, there's been a lot happening here in terms of conversations around political media. But Fox News, it seems like they're going to keep forging ahead from where they're at. That's not to say that there aren't obstacles ahead. So they already had a massive settlement with a voting machine company, Dominion, and they are dealing with a similar lawsuit. It's a $2.7 billion lawsuit from Smartmatic, which is another voting machine maker. And this is, you know, stemming from stuff that happened during the 2020 election and the alleged spread of misinformation. And with the with this in mind, you know, it's that's going to be an obstacle that Lachlan has to deal with. The media industry in general is struggling as more people switch from cable to streaming. Fox has launched its own streaming service called Fox One. So it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out. That just happened in August. And on the News Corp side, you know, the Wall Street Journal, you know, even though it's really growing its digital audience, you know, it's a tough time for newspapers, for online news. People are going elsewhere to get information. I'm thinking social media. And, you know, it's not an easy road ahead, but he does have a healthy empire. He does have a stable empire. We've seen stock prices go up for both, you know, Fox and News Corp over the years. And yeah, he just, he can buckle. I think in his mind, he can buckle down now and just focus on the strategy.
He can, but he'll still have to go by what his dad says.
I mean, I'm sure Rupert is still providing plenty of
I'd say
of
he hasn't gone off the WhatsApp group. I'd say not. I think it would be also worth asking you, though, about the other three siblings at the moment. So James, like, he was by Rupert's side for the phone tapping scandal. He is on the Tesla board and he found himself leapfrogged in the business when Lachlan came back into the fold, particularly around that time of 21st Century Fox, etc. It seems Prudence has shown a lot of interest in running the business per se. And of course, Elizabeth Murdoch is quite a successful media entrepreneur herself. So where do you see the family influence now moving on between those three, Hannah? Or will they simply take their pot and live happily ever after?
Yeah, I mean, for the other three, they've all had their lives and professional careers, you know, touch media in various ways. And I think they've all, you know, had their success on their own. You mentioned James, you know, he was eyed as a potential successor. Lachlan and Rupert, you know, were distant for a few years. You know, Lachlan stepped away from the empire for a bit. But with the phone hacking scandals, you know, James was sort of the face of that and stepped down. He's also much more public about being more politically left-leaning. He and his wife, Catherine, have donated to more left-leaning causes. They're very passionate about awareness around climate change. Elizabeth and Prudence, you know, again, they have their own careers. Elizabeth in particular, you know, she has Sister Pictures, you know, the film production company. It'll be really interesting to see what lies ahead. I do want to say there is a lot of, you know, M&A activity right now in the media space. You know, there is stuff changing hands. It's very active with deal making right now. And they all three of them have a lot of money to play with. So it'll be interesting to see if they, you know, make any big moves.
Well, you heard it here first. Well, thanks so much indeed, Hannah Miller, for joining me, media reporter at Bloomberg in New York.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, this is Susan A's Culleton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And now for our economic trivia. Well, I was working with the Credit Union Managers Association this week, and I learned a lot about their 3.6 million members across the island of Ireland and their 17.9 billion euro of assets. But here are my two questions for you. First, when did the first credit union open in Ireland? And how many credit unions exist around the world? If you know the answers to that, email me at takingstock@newstalk.com and I will give you the answer at the end of the show. After the break, we talk to the chairperson of IFAC about calling time on If I Have It, I'll Spend It. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton. Now, the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council released its pre-budget statement this week, and it had some tough love advice for the government. So Seamus Coffey, Chair of IFAC, joins me to discuss the detail of this. Seamus, the report says, given that the economy is performing well, this is not a time for a large budget package. And yet, this week on Tuesday, when this was being reported, we also learned that one in five children are living below the poverty line. I heard Pierce Doherty this week being interviewed where he said there should be over 900 million euros spent on three universal energy credits. Simon Harris was on the radio this week talking about reform to child benefit. The economy might be performing well, Seamus, and you document that well very much in the report, but lots of people aren't.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that is something that we'd acknowledge. But essentially, like the advice would be that the government faces choices. Just given the current position of the economy, the very strong position, the low unemployment, the high growth in employment, if the government is increasing spending pretty rapidly and if it's cutting taxes, it's adding demand to an economy that doesn't need it in overall terms. And we know that these cyclical positions don't tend to be permanent. The economy goes through ups and downs. And we're very much going through a strong phase of growth at the moment. And when it comes to these issues you've gone through, yes, there are things that the government should address, but it shouldn't take an everything now approach. If there's targeted income supports it wants to offer, as additional services it wants to offer in other areas, doing that in a sustainable fashion doesn't mean it can't do that. But we've seen in Ireland things like when times are good and we introduced tax cuts or spending measures or pay increases for public sector staff, that when a downturn hits, we can actually reverse some of those and we actually make the downturn even worse. At a time when the economy needs support, we actually end up with the government increasing taxes and cutting spending, which is a cycle we want to get out of.
Well, picking up particularly on the increase in spending, because that's a point you make a lot in the report, and I delved into the data pack to see what was really underpinning that. And I want to ask you about health spending, because you say that health spending is projected to rise by 4.1% this year, and year to date, spending is up 5.8%. Now, we know the population is growing, and it's growing faster than had anticipated by, let's say, parties like the SRI. But where is that money going from health spending perspective, Seamus?
Yeah, I guess one thing we look at when it comes to the government providing services in areas like health is the cost of just doing what we're doing now, and the mind adding additional services and additional supports on there. Just the cost of what we're doing now is going to increase. Yes, because certain costs go up, and also, as you say, because the population is going up. So just even to stand still does require an increase in expenditure. It's not that when the government announces an increase in spending for the budget that has the scope to do lots of new things. In fact, if you look at it, the cost of doing just what it's doing now will eat up an awful lot of that. And when it comes to areas like health, like one thing we've had concerns with over the last number of years is just an unrealistic starting point. That just taking into consideration what you're doing now is actually going to cost more. So for the year as a whole, as I say, the government planned a budget increase of around 4% for health. And up to the end of August, we're running at 6%. So it's pretty clear that budget will be exceeded for the year as a whole. In part, it's down to that sort of unrealistic starting point. You should have put in more scope at the start of the year to cover those additional costs. So when it comes to like individual measures, that's not necessarily something that we look at. But just the cost of doing what we're doing now is costing more. That's gone up 6%. And as you say, the population is growing. There's more people. We have more elderly people. Thankfully, people are living longer. That's putting more pressures on the health sector. And if we had more realistic figures to begin with, it's likely we could reduce these overruns and these sort of issues that appear in terms of our budgets on an ongoing basis. That we set out figures each year at the start of the year, and for the past number of years, they've always been exceeded.
Well, whatever about the 4% and the 6% that you mentioned in health, when I looked at education and children, spending is up 7.5% year to date, whereas the projection for the year was just 2.5%. Now, I know there are different quantums, but your point about the overrun or the unanticipated changes there are even more stark. But Seamus, I could quote all sorts of observations to you about how Ireland's education output is improving all the time. Therefore, is the issue the increase in spending, the unforeseen increasing in spending, the efficacy of spending, or what is the issue here, do you think?
In large part, it's sort of the unforeseen nature of the spending. As you say, across education, children, and justice, spending is up 7.5% in the year. That in itself would be fine, but the budgeted amount was 2.5%. If we go back 12 months ago and look at the discussion we were having around the budget 12 months ago, the planned increase in spending for 2025 across all government areas was around 3 billion. If we look at what the government did in their most recent publication, the Summer Economic Statement, they added a further 3.3 billion to that. So they can adopt that kind of slipped out during the summer, there was a greater increase in spending in that than there was in the sort of the fanfare that met the budget last year. And in fact, our own analysis suggests that even that additional 3.3 billion won't be sufficient to cover the overruns that are likely to rise. So we started off last year with the government saying that increased spending in 2025 by 3 billion. We're likely to end up with a situation where spending this year will rise by 7 or 8 billion. That's not to say that's necessarily wrong, but if we're going to do it, let's set it out at the start of the year so we can have a decent assessment of what's happening, rather than producing figures that are unrealistic, maybe arguing at the time that, oh, spending in 2025 will grow by a lower amount. And you hear the government now saying that spending in 2026 will grow by a lower amount. Well, actually, we need to look at what's happening this year first and see that spending this year will grow pretty rapidly. And if the government sets out more moderate growth forecasts for 2026, if the pattern of previous years is to be repeated, they will be exceeded again.
I'm really getting your point here, which is that if we don't know what we're dealing with, how can we prepare for it? And our focus on this conversation so far has been current spending, but I want to move to capital spending because you note... When I say you, obviously, I mean IFAC. You note that half of projects are unlikely to be completed on time, according to the National Development Plan Tracker. And again, on the same day as your report came out on Tuesday, we saw that all sectors of the construction industry reported a slowdown in August. Seamus, for the first time in 18 months. Now, if this is the biggest challenge facing the country, is the issue, do you think, money? Is it planning? Is it water, electricity, politics? Like, we're dealing with an otherwise full employment economy and a rising population. What's the problem?
Yeah, I suppose infrastructure and sort of our capital assets would be something that the council have looked at over the last number of years. Again, like, has our capital stock in housing, transport, communications, health, education, has our actual capital stock kept pace with what we should have and but also with our growing population? And it's pretty clear that it hasn't. We would be behind our peer countries in terms of the depth and level of capital stock we have. So there is the opportunity there to increase that when that does take additional investment. Is the issue money? Well, not necessarily. Like, as we say, the economy is going through a very strong phase of growth at the moment. So the public finances have large revenues coming in. Income tax and VAT are performing strongly. Of course, we know the corporation tax is going absolutely gangbusters. So the issue isn't necessarily money. Like, one of the issues is not only do we face sort of constraints in terms of housing and the lack of supply there, we also possibly face constraints in the labour market. We could say, oh, we want to increase housing output, or we want to do retrofits or increase rail transport, cycling, road, build schools and hospitals. We can say we want to do all of that, but where are the workers going to come to actually allow us to achieve that? Previously, 10, 15, 20 years ago, we'd have brought many of those workers in from Eastern Europe. Now their economies are performing much better. So maybe that supply of skilled labour isn't available. So one of the issues is that we're in a sort of very strong performing economy. We want to do lots of things, but maybe the scope isn't there to do it. Like, if, for example, we wanted to transform our car fleet from combustion engines to electric cars, we could actually do that pretty quickly because we have the money and we could get workers in France or Germany or Japan or even China to make the electric cars and we just buy them. But when it comes to houses and schools and roads, we have to build them here. And unless we have the skilled labour to do that, will we face difficulties? And there are other things you can look at, as you mentioned there, things like planning, etc. And again, the setting of realistic timelines and budgets are all issues that can be improved on. But money isn't necessarily the one we face when it comes to improving our capital stock. There are non-money, non-monetary areas that the government can look to improve, maybe on the planning, on the supply of labour, and maybe trying to make space for that additional capital investment into the economy that's performing very well.
Well, speaking of an economy that is exactly, as you say, performing very well, there's a pithy line in the briefing that says, budgetary policy is already providing unnecessary support. So, Seamus, I put it to you, what spending or tax policy is unnecessarily supportive?
Well, at the fiscal council, we wouldn't necessarily look at individual or specific tax or spending measures. We would look at the overall impact of the government's budgetary policy on the economy and the public finances as a whole. And if you just look at the last number of years, like, we've seen government spending growing at rates of 8, 10%. And that is, some of that might have been justified back in 2022 and 2023 when inflation was very high, but now we have inflation back down below 2%. And if spending is growing at close to 10%, that is putting large demand out into the economy that doesn't necessarily need it. And in fact, if we look at the government's own summary economic statement, it actually contains sort of an unusual feature in that they set out a plan, a budgetary package of 9.4 billion for 2026. But they did include one line. They said that if the environment deteriorates, perhaps due to tariff policy in the US or maybe another negative shock that might hit the economy, they said if the environment deteriorates, the budgetary package would be smaller. So they're saying that while times are good, We have a large package of 9.4 billion. But actually, if the economy was to hit a speed bump of some form, or the economy was to slow down, they would reduce the size of the budgetary package. And that runs counter to your sort of classic sort of textbook approach to fiscal policy, that fiscal policy should be countercyclical. You should do more when the economy needs it and not do less when the economy needs it.
And Seamus, that is exactly what the like of you and I learn and lecture on, let's say, when we're in that environment. But I'm wondering, is where the government's coming from, not because I'm agreeing with it, but just to put another context on it, is it, we won't have the taxes to spend as much, therefore we won't be in a position to be able to take that decision. But like Charlie McCreevy said, if we have it, we'll spend it.
So there's echoes of that in what we're seeing now. So the government clearly have the tax revenue at the moment. As you say, income tax and VAT, and especially corporation tax, are pouring in at very rapid rates. But we've seen the dangers of putting in place permanent spending commitments on the basis of revenues that turn out to be temporary. So the economy isn't always going to be performing as strong as it is now. And really, we really can't rely on those corporation tax receipts because they come from such a small number of companies, particularly from a small number of US companies. So we are very much in the whims of US policy that could change there. And the problem is that if we introduce permanent spending measures now, all these income supports and other things that are being proposed on the basis of the tax revenue that's there now, what do we do with that tax revenue dries up? Mm-hmm. But if we give ourselves a bit of sort of leeway and a bit of capacity to absorb a bit of a hit, so by the government, by running surpluses now when the economy is forming strongly and doesn't need additional support, if we were to get that hit, well, maybe we just go back to a position of a balanced budget and we could continue to do the spending commitments that have been entered without having to see tax increases and spending cuts at a time when the economy actually would need the opposite. So that's sort of lying in the summary economic statement. It's a bit sort of contra to what we might hope would be happening. Given where we are now, we don't need huge fiscal support. And if we were to hit that shock, that'd be the time to step in. We saw it in COVID when large parts of the economy were shut down. The public finances stepped in and offered huge support to households and businesses. Now, that was a global shock. Monetary policy and the ECB were very accommodative of that stance, not allowed all governments to do that. But if we're hit with an Ireland-specific shock, we can't expect help to come from elsewhere. The ECB isn't going to set its policy because Ireland has been negatively hit by US trade policy. And if we are to hit that shock, we need to develop the capacity ourselves to be able to absorb it, not going through this boom-bust cycle of, as you say, spending the money when it's coming in and then cutting back when the money dries up.
Seamus, I'm sure there's lots of people listening to us today that are nodding furiously. And in the press release, you talk about the need for, and I quote, a revised medium-term fiscal plan alongside the budget, which really underlines what you've just been saying there now, to see beyond today and tomorrow. And like I say, I'm sure lots of people would be nodding their heads profusely. But what I was surprised at was after that, then you said, if taken seriously, the plan could move Ireland away from year-to-year budgeting. Why wouldn't it be taken seriously, Seamus? Or do you think the government takes the advice of the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council seriously at all?
But in this instance, we're looking at what are our commitments made under EU regulations and EU directives. So the EU has moved to a more multi-annual approach to assessing member states' public finances, and governments are required to submit a multi-year plan. Now,
but sure, is anyone taking any notes of that? Like, look at what's going on there in France. Like, I mean, does it, you know, is that just an agreement? But should we see?
On the basis of this, a prime minister did try to stick to the plan that they had set forward, and he lost a vote of confidence in the French parliament during the week. And in the case of Ireland, we actually don't have a plan at all. We've no guide to tell us where fiscal policy might be going over the next 2, 3, 4 years.
That's maybe because we need a girl.
A technical document was submitted by the last government before the election, but that really didn't have any basis. The government themselves, in their own programme for government, they said that this multi-year plan would be published with the summary economic statement, but they backtracked from that and we haven't seen it yet. So like the previous government had a certain percentage that it was looking to keep to in terms of spending increases. This medium-term plan would set out maybe different percentage increases over different years, but at least would give us a guide or a benchmark or a framework over what the government expects to do. At the moment, we're a bit flying blind. We've that sort of unrealistic figure set out in last year's budget that had been exceeded as we go through the year, with spending growing by more than double what was initially set out. That the possibility of further policy measures for 2025, even though we should be talking about budget 2026. And as of yet, we're still not sure what budget 2026 will look like in overall terms. The details are for the government to choose. What we're concerned with is the impact in overall terms. And that framework, that multi-year framework, would allow departments to plan better. We could say, look, we'll be able to add this additional service in 2026, and then we'll have resources in 2027 for this additional service. Whereas at the moment, we go from year to year, perhaps even going from quarter or even month to month, with things changing. And that sort of means we have very short run thinking, whereas even medium term is only 2, 3, 4 years. Get a bit of sense of stability about what we're at in terms of our approach to budgeting, and also get the figures to be more credible and realistic set out, and that agencies like the Fiscal Council actually have credible figures to assess. Like, if we went back and looked at last year's budget and assessed it, we might think, oh, that looks reasonably sound, spending increase of 4 or 5% for 2025. But actually, we've gone through the year, the spending increase is close to 10%. Like, what would we be saying back then if we knew what's actually happening now? So a more credible and sort of realistic approach is what's needed, rather than repeating the pattern of these spending and overruns, and sort of drift in government spending away from the plan.
And I just want to ask you one last question, Seamus, because I think it's what I really liked in the full report is the way in which you look for the canary in the coal mine, when you say that it's easy for labour statistics to miss pivotal turning points in the economy, and you point out the three things to watch: card spending data, administrative data on employment, and monthly tax receipts. Can I just ask, from the methodology of IFAC, do you control for inflation in card spending, a rising population in employment, and the volatility of the seasonality that comes with tax receipts?
Oh, yes. In most of those, you'd be looking at rates or ratios. So like when it comes to card spending, you're looking for real increases. Are people actually buying more quantities? So you would be adjusting for inflation. In terms of the employment, you'd be looking for the employment rate, the share of the labour force that are working, the share of the population that are working. So yes, absolutely. You can get nominal increases, but unless they're actually backed up with real quantity increases, the figures don't amount to much. So the work that the Fiscal Council had done and the statistics published by the Central Statistics Office would take into account those things like the rate of inflation when it comes to spending. Are people actually buying more? And yes, they are. The economy is in a strong state. Employment is quite high. So spending is rising. And then the employment. Is our employment position improving? Absolutely. The employment rate is at a record level for Ireland. If you go back historically, our employment rate, like the share of the working age population we're working, will actually have been around 70%.
The labour market, Seamus, is something that we've looked at several times indeed in the show, and we will certainly continue to do that. I'm really delighted that I had the chance to talk to you about this, because there's really a lot of meat in the report that was produced this week. So keep doing what you're doing. Seamus Coffey, Chair of the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, thanks so much for joining me. This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. Up next, can an AI agent cure a broken heart? Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton, and I want to read you a message that I received after interviewing Olaf Storbeck 2 weeks ago about the German government giving each child 10 euros a month to invest in the stock market. Monica sent me a message saying, "Children from age 7 onwards should be encouraged to understand money as a school subject. Children never fail to protect themselves once given the information in an age-appropriate way. Of course, it has to be balanced with the protection of the planet, and there is a nice equilibrium or maxim of, I have enough, I am enough, I'm a human being, not a human doing." So if anybody else has thoughts on young people in financial literacy, please do email me in at takingstock@newstalk.com, as it's a topic that is very close to my heart. Now, you know the feeling. You have a query about a bill or something that you bought, and you're in customer service only to be met by a series of dial 1, 2 or 3 options, all powered by AI, and there isn't a human being in earshot. Well, how is this making us feel about customer service, and what might it mean for those working in the field? So I'm delighted to be joined by Elaine Burke of the For Tech's Sake podcast and Vinnie O'Brien from Vinnie and Co Consulting. So first of all, Elaine, can I start with you? Agentic AI, right? If we look at the technical definition, it says AI programs that are capable of independent decision making and action in pursuit of goals. Like, what does that mean in plain English?
It's just the next step in automation, really.
Oh, like, okay, that's a lot easier.
Like with a lot of AI technologies, it's just this idea. And it's actually the thing about agents that sets them apart from maybe AI or automation that people have encountered before now is that they tend to have a bit more interoperability. So sometimes if you're...
Interoperability,
yes,
Elaine.
So across different programs, different data sets, different databases and things like that, they tend to be able to work like a person would be able to do on a computer and visit this website to get this information and use that information to input somewhere else. If you think of it that way, that's where you're getting into more of an agentic level of automation. It's when it can do multiple tasks that probably engage different programs, different services to interact with.
And thus a higher level of complexity.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Vinnie, can we talk about this on a practical level, please? Because by 2029, they say agentic AI will independently handle 80% of routine customer service inquiries. Like, does this include things like, say, self-service portals or something far beyond?
It includes everything that you can kind of imagine that's in that space, to be honest, Susan. I think of something like Revolut as a really good example. I think they hit something like 3 million customers across Ireland in late 2024. That's all fully automated in terms of how it handles customer service. So when we think of how technology is now being sold into businesses large and small, it's being sold with the idea that we can be more efficient than people. It doesn't really tell the full picture. I think what we've decided is that there is a less costly route to try and solve a problem we know exists. We don't want to solve the problem at its core, and we're going to use this cheap, what we classify as cheap and easy technology to deploy to try and get rid of a problem rather than try and solve it at its core. So anywhere that there is a customer service touch point, I think, comes into the realm of being automated within that time. And this is not something that's new to here. We've had a call center environment in Ireland for quite a long time where we've been happy to routinely give over the handling of queries into various centers en masse, so that you look at things like utilities. They've been hugely affected. Banks, post offices, credit unions all around the country. No customers ever said that they wanted that. All they ever want is their problem to be solved, not for it to be solved quicker, in a more timely fashion or in a less costly fashion. They just want to have their voice heard. And I think there's this dichotomy now developing what is right for the customer versus what is right for business. And it's a tough one with cost rising. So I can see how the challenge is going to go on and debates like this should happen over the next couple of years.
Elaine, Vinnie just said there that the customer didn't ask for this. What they asked for was for their problem to be solved. And while that is the case, perhaps they don't care about how it's solved as long as that it is solved. But of course, what a company would naturally care about is how much it costs to solve it. Because OpenAI reports that an average support ticket costs $40 in labour and in overlapping systems to store knowledge. So is the role of companies to use these technologies well, but in such a way that is in line with what the customer wants so that they can get the problem solved or the information that they need?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that it's like they're selling this idea that this cost that you're spending on customer service should be lower. Like that seems to be just this constant refrain when it comes to where companies decide to cut costs. And it frequently astounds me, frankly, because why would the thing that's like front facing with your company, with your customers to solve problems for them, why is that expendable? Shouldn't that be such a much more high value aspect of your organization? But as we all know, as customers, it often isn't. It's very rare that it's something that is considered high value at the top level of organizations. It's something that's often seen as expendable, something that should have cost cutting measures applied to it. We're all familiar with the outsourcing of customer service. We're all familiar with the increased automation of customer service and the frustration that causes. And when you see, say, every year, the types of companies that come up quite a bit in terms of the frustration that people have in terms of customer service, they are seen as they're just not doing right by their customers. Customers feel there's kind of an unjustness to how they're being treated. And, you know, the CCPC report most recently was Air, Sky and Ryanair, I believe, are the top three offenders there. Ryanair is kind of a technology pioneer when it comes to how it runs its business and trying to do things in an automated way and guide people towards certain behaviours and selections in their processes. And people feel cheated by that. So that's why you get bad rankings. And that's just on the tech side of things. Obviously, there's way more aspects to being a Ryanair customer than the tech side of it. And I know from my own experience when talking to people that with Air and Sky, it's about being put through a loop with people. And it's often they're on the phone with a real person, but they're just feeling like they're not progressing anywhere and that they're not being heard. As Vinnie said, people want to feel like they're being heard and listened to. I don't think you solve these problems by adding increasing automation and actually defunding your customer service. And he makes a really good point there. Like, are you solving problems or are you trapping customers in a loop, distracting them to the point of exhaustion, sending them to the seventh circle of hell, which is like an infinite loop of customer service that never ends?
Well, I think that anybody listening today can certainly feel that sense of frustration. One of my favourite lines to use with a chatbot is talk to an agent, because then I will see whether I can actually do that or whether they'll direct me off to support or something else like that. But you're right there, Elaine, is that the difference here is how you're being heard. And of course, the other side of this is that we want speed as well. Like, I want to be able to engage with whoever it might be, maybe I'm sitting at home on a Saturday evening at 9:30. I don't want to wait until Monday morning at 9 a.m. to open. But and these things do matter. And if we can just switch tack here, Vinny, for a moment. I was thinking in preparation for today of all the ways now that we use AI in our own business. And one of the ones I really like is I have an AI note taker in meetings, and it generates summaries of what we've talked about. If I can't be there myself, it sends me in, theoretically, in as listen mode into a meeting. And it, like I say, it generates a summary with action points. And many companies are using these, and they see case documentation time dropping by as much as 75 to 80% due to AI summaries. This is a positive development then, isn't it?
I suppose it depends on what your output to be and where you're, what kind of information that you need and what you need to do with it. Because the accuracy sometimes in a lot of the transcription tools is about 80 to 90% accurate, and it may be in the 10% that you need that detail. Other things that it doesn't do brilliantly all the time, I find, are things like defining who is speaking at any one time, and you can lose some of the context then as well. And if you're only ever reading the transcripts, you tend to fall into that mode of maybe getting a little bit lazy. At least I know I do. I use it all the time. But you maybe get lazy in meetings and you don't engage in the way that you do. So there's all these other hidden costs. As much as I love the technologies, they become very, very helpful. I do a lot of podcast scripting. So my job is really to try and engage and to listen to people. But you can find yourself falling into that trap where you're getting lazy and not really engaging in the conversation. And I think there's some of the kind of hidden costs, as I said, to how we use these tools. And then there's absenteeism. It's very easy to say no to something and turn it down at the last minute and not turn up regardless of what's going on, just because you have this there in lieu of yourself. And again, these are the sort of things that we need to quantify. The way that we're going to learn about them, I guess, is by taking time to review how effective they are, what are the hidden costs. And one of the points that Elaine made, I think, is really pertinent, or even that you've said yourself, is who are the people that are not picking up the phone that maybe we could be solving problems for or trying to help out? And we talk about these efficiency tools as being problem solvers. But if that $40 that OpenAI claimed that it costs to open a ticket, maybe that's a thing that keeps you a customer for 2 years or 3 years. And for someone like myself, who's an independent consultant, the ability to retain a customer and hold on to them over a long period of time like that might be worth the $40 for me to have a ticket open or for me to be able to pick up the phone and speak to someone directly. So I think there's a lot of variables that yet have to play out before we decide, is the efficiency worth it? And is that cost saving really the thing we should be focusing our investment on, as Elaine has said?
I'd love to hear our audience's reaction to this. So please do email us in takingstock@newstalk.com and tell us, did you ever not pick up the phone to a company because you just got frustrated with an automated service, and what has happened as a result of that? Elaine, can I ask you for inspiration then? Because you've talked about which companies may not be the most pleasing, let's say, when it comes to customer service. Where can we learn about or take inspiration from companies who are using AI or even just generally automation customer service well?
Well, I mean, there is Intercom, the Irish-led startup that has built itself from day one as being an automated customer service tool, and increasingly AI becomes part of that automation that they're using. So they didn't jump on the AI bandwagon when it got sexy in the last few years. This has kind of always been their bread and butter. And they have a very interesting team that works within the organization that is all about doing the data science research around customer acceptance and adoption. And they actually release some of the information around that research, which is well worth looking into if this is something that you're considering, because you do need social acceptance of these tools. Like, you are going to anger customers if you roll these things out clumsily, and that is not going to do well for you as a brand. And it might even be something that causes friction that you haven't properly identified where that was caused. Because as you were saying, like, it's people who just logged on, saw it was an automated customer service system and thought, I actually can't be dealing with this, so I'm just going to cancel my subscription and move on to someone else or something like that. Because, you know, there will be competitors out there that are offering something different. And then an example on the other extreme of that is a company that IPO'd this very week, Klarna, which is the buy now, pay later button that you'll see on a lot of shopping websites these days. It's this pink coloured logo.
A fintech company,
just IPO'd at a value of $15 billion. So, I mean, they're doing well as a company. But in terms of customer service and AI, their CEO, Sebastian Siemiatkowski, was really keen on this kind of idea of slashing employment numbers in favour of AI agents, and was very, very much boasting about that in the press, and realised fairly quickly after that that it wasn't going well. Customers were not being served very well by this system, and found that kind of similar to what Vinny said about like losing a customer and trying to regain them, as like retention is much more valuable than trying to obtain a new customer, because that costs you more money. It also costs you more money to hire staff again.
Oh, for sure.
And they have been struggling now to rehire the customer service staff that they've realised that they now need to fill that gap, and have had to reportedly get, you know, their high level engineers and staff who are responsible for other roles to be answering the calls to their customer team to make sure that they weren't going to be losing customers as well. And now he's changed tack, Sebastian Siemiatkowski, and he has said he kind of wants Klarna to become a company where you know you can reach a person with your customer service query. So complete 360 there.
But you know, Elaine, I actually came across a statistic this week that really backs up what you and Sebastian are saying, which is by 2027, 50% of business planning major customer service job cuts due to AI will reverse course, partly because of that, of what you've said, but also because many businesses underestimate the complexity and challenges of transitioning an AI-powered agent-less customer service and experience model. So, Vinny, what are the challenges that companies need to face and overcome if they are going to go further down this agentic route? Because we know the tools and technologies are there. So what mistakes should they not make in pursuing them?
I think we have this pursuit of everything being solved in a very short time period. So we've got to expand what our horizons are there. I spoke with a Swedish company this morning, or a Danish, I should say, and we were talking about the fact that a 40-year time frame is probably more realistic to see is the impact what we think it should be.
40 years?
Yeah, I think it is. It's a generational thing. And I kind of understand what they mean. We tend to think in terms of dog years now and say, well, can we solve something in 6 months? I mean, the Klarna story is really interesting, Elaine, that you've brought up. They've done their 180 in less than 12 months, but they're operating at huge scale. So it depends on what size business that you are. Not every business will need their own agent to do things for them, and not every individual will need agents as well. So I think the companies to figure out, can they provide that agentic platform on behalf of their customers and serve them properly, rather than everyone say, well, we want our consumer or our customer to have an agent working for them, and that's going to talk to our agent. So I think it's understanding the relationships that need to exist. And Elaine has given some really good examples already.
And we're going to have to leave it there, Vinny. But what I'm taking away from you both is that we need human plus AI plus dog years equals the gold standard. Thank you both very much indeed. Elaine Burke for Tech's Sake and Vinny O'Brien from Vinny & Co Consulting. Now, to give you the answers to my two economic trivia questions. The first credit union opened in Ireland in 1958 and I was surprised by the answer to this one, there are over 74,000 credit unions in 104 countries around the world. So that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and hopefully learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day, and I look forward to chatting to you again next week.